This podcast is part of the Podcast Arcade Network.
Hello and welcome to the Goat Kicker Podcast. I am your host, Carl D. Smith. Welcome to the 21st episode of the Goat Kicker, number 3 for this particular calendar week. Actually, 3 in 3 days, not too shabby. Have a little extra gumption this week, a little extra free time that I don't normally have in the mornings. So I'm going to try to help pad the content in case over the next couple weeks I don't have an opportunity again. As I mentioned before, I'm going to be working some overnights. Working overnights is sort of interesting because overnight staff typically, at least in my experience when it comes to healthcare, are their own animal. There's a different kind of dog that does an overnight shift on a regular basis. Pharmacists are typically weird anyway, but an overnight pharmacist is usually pretty quirky. And to be honest, the customers you deal with and the situations you find yourself in after midnight are almost equally, if not more so, quirky. In retail pharmacy and in hospital pharmacy, you know, institutions that are open 24 hours a day and usually open on holidays don't really recognize man's calendar and man's law. A lot of times they work these shifts where they have 7 on and 7 off. They'll work 7 overnights, get 80 hours for the pay period, and then get 7 days off. Or if, you know, in the old days they were a little more generous, you wouldn't work 80 hours, you'd get paid 80 hours on top of like your differential that you already get for working overnights, because it's such a hard shift to staff regularly. So you'd work like 72 hours, I think it comes out to, or and you get paid for 80 or 74. And for a long time, that was kind of what sweetened the pot for people to take that position. And then every time there was a review of ins and outs with profit and money and spending, and you'd lose hours for technicians. Eventually, they eyeballed that overnight shift and started taking stuff away from them. So now you have a bunch of really especially quirky members of an already quirky population who are isolated from peer contact. They don't have technicians with them. At most, they just have whoever's working the front end register with them or some stock boy. So you have these characters, and now you have them disgruntled. And I've seen it really chew up a lot of souls. Some really bitter pharmacists, for instance, working overnight shifts. I'm not sure about nursing. I'm not sure if the overnight nurses are any more or less weird than the daytime ones. But I will tell you this, as someone that religiously has worked what I would consider the second shift throughout most of his career, about half of my career, I shouldn't exaggerate. But you feel weird when you work a 9-to-5 shift. You're like a part of the world at large, the world that can plan things on evenings and not have to worry if they work that night. People who can commit to things like softball teams and bowling leagues. People who can say yes to teaching Sunday school classes because they know they're going to be off on Sunday because it's the weekend. It's the weekend, for Pete's sake. Why wouldn't I be able to? And it makes you a little strange even to work those sort of schedules. You're out of sync with the world at large. You don't live a normal life. You don't get regular sleep. The idea of having any sort of consistent, regular, predictable plan at exercise, for instance, is super laughable, because there are days when you could get up and go running at 8 o'clock and have had 8 hours of sleep. There are times when you can get up and go running at 8 and you would have only been in bed for 4 hours prior. And there's times when you get up to go running at 8 where you've only been home for work for an hour or less. So working overnights is an interesting deal. The only advantage of working overnights, especially for those of us who are nerds, and excuse my cough there, is some of the free time that you've gained by that. When the rest of the world is slaving away in their cubicles, you're free to roam the earth. You can hit comic book stores. You can hit bookstores. It's basically you, the stay-at-homes, and the retirees out running the world. I can go eat lunch at 1:30. Take my time. I can have brunch, which is like perhaps life's greatest treasure is having midweek brunch. It's glorious. It's a glorious occurrence. It doesn't happen nearly often enough. But a lot of us are accustomed to staying up late anyway as nerds, because a lot of our endeavors are pretty much solo or private. They're not really shared with people in our lives, not on an appreciable manner. And for those of us who actually attempt to be present in the lives of our families and our friends, you know, we often shelve our hobbies until we have time to ourselves. And so if I'm going to watch a movie or play some video games or write my books or read a book, a lot of times that happens when everybody else is in bed. And that isn't related so much to my work schedule as it is, that's just the way it's always been. From way back as a child, when I was reading Ray Bradbury and Tolkien in my bed with a reading lamp. Nighttime has always been the time when my nerdiness gets to do what it wants. Without interruption, without harassment. And so for a lot of us who already have these particularly sedentary hobbies, staying up late's just part of the deal. So working an overnight shift, for instance, or deep into the night, doesn't really feel like you're sacrificing too much. If it wasn't for my children, who I have to make sure get to school in the morning, the idea of working fewer shifts a week overnight for more money and being allowed to sleep throughout the day and get up mid-afternoon on the nights that I'm working, there's not a lot of downside to that. There just isn't. You're driving contrary to traffic. You're awake for the portion of the day when your significant other is home from work. It's not a bad situation, to be honest. This is something I've come to grips with recently. Thus is why I volunteered to pick up these shifts. And the other advantage that makes you uniquely maybe accustomed to this sort of shift as a nerd is that it's a very solitary shift. It can be scary in a position like mine where sometimes I need a little backup because you can't predict the incoming calls or the severity of the calls. I'm still only not much over a year, into my career as a poison center pharmacist, as a specialist in poison information. I haven't even been certified yet. I don't take my test until next year. So I have almost been at the job 2 years before I take my certification. So there's a lot of things I don't know. And if you work anything remotely close to healthcare or IT, I suppose, would be very similar, is that the situations that come up are very rarely textbook. There's a lot of creative problem solving. There's a lot of unique things that happen with patients and substances that that aren't by the book. If they were by the book and it was that easy, then we wouldn't be needed. So a lot of times a physician, when they call us, they've already tried all the obvious, easy stuff, and they have a patient that's not responding or has a mystery ingestion that they're not improving from. And those are the situations they need help with. And so that's the sort of thing that sometimes you get caught in the middle of. Or when they call to have help coordinating a large exposure, like a hazmat situation. And if you're the only one at work, that can be troublesome. Because you're just one person trying to coordinate all these phone calls in between the incoming phone calls and all the other duties that you're required to take care of. But for the most part, the solitude is nice. There are often lulls, regardless of what the pharmacist will tell you when they try to oversell how lucky you are that they're working that shift for you. Everybody likes to be a martyr, but regardless of what they'll tell you, there are lulls when you can get caught up on typing. There's no phone calls coming in. There's no other souls around. You can fire up a radio and listen to whatever music you want to listen to, even if it's only for a half hour. But that's a boon. I can listen to some podcast. I can flip over to Google Docs and kind of cheat the system by working on my projects during work time. Or if I'm a good employee, I can work on my work projects on work time instead of my own time, which, you know, that door swings both ways. And it's pleasant. It's pleasant to be in control of the office, to be able to take your shoes off, listen to your own music, wear cargo shorts to work, which I cannot explain how much that's worth financially. And all you really have to do is fight your circadian rhythm. Other than that, there's not a lot of downsides. So I'll be doing that over the next month. Maybe I'll sing a different tune at the end of it. I'll be the first one to admit it here on Goad Kicker if that's the case. But I'm curious, you know, do nerds make better overnight employees? Is that why they're so quirky? Are they typically nerds? Or is there something else going on there? Or does being a night owl predispose you to being a nerd? Being someone who likes to linger on cable TV and mill about the house late at night, needing to find something semi-quiet and semi-private to do, does that lend itself to particular behaviors? Does it make you more likely to be a nerd? To someone who will binge read through an entire series of comic books or perhaps become some sort of online gaming addict? Before I close out the open here, when World of Warcraft was first introduced to me, it changed my life a little bit, and I was kind of thankful almost immediately that A, I don't have a good computer, B, I didn't have good internet at home that was reliable, and C, that it didn't come out when I was in high school, because I'm pretty sure the little bit of social life that I had would have been completely absent. But I did manage to play some World of Warcraft, and the way I was able to do so was after my wife had gone to bed, I could stay up and study for a while. I didn't get too judged for that because I obviously had some studying to do. I worked almost nearly full-time as a pharmacy technician while I went to pharmacy school, and it's amazing to me to think what I achieved and what I could have achieved had I not been so distracted, because I still shoveled in a tremendous amount of distraction into my life. But But anyway, you know, you use this, the studying and the routine as an excuse to not go to bed at the same time every night or what have you. And I'd be up and I'd fire up World of Warcraft. I was able to pull wireless connection pretty much from my neighbors. And they were in bed, so I wasn't really competing for bandwidth with them. I lived in an apartment at the time, and this is what you do. this is how life works, apparently. And so anyway, I'd be able to play at night, and I found myself able to play with you know, a lot of people who had similar schedules as myself or who lived overseas. So a lot of when you join these clans or what have you online, which I never used headsets or communication, so it was kind of pointless. But when you join these groups, a lot of times there were people from Korea or Australia or New Zealand. Sometimes they were from not quite as far away. But I got this cool world exposure. And it made me more nerdy. It made me want to play the game more, because not only was the game fun, I got to meet strange and interesting people. And I sometimes wonder if someone had a job that required them to be at work by 6:30 a.m. and had a lot of responsibility that was, you know, physically and intellectually demanding and worked long hours and had children. I often wonder, you know, if that person's going to bed by 9 o'clock at night out of just pure necessity for physical survival, are they less likely to become a hardcore nerd? Are they the type of person you talk to at a convention or a bar or some social gathering, and they mention that, oh yeah, I used to like reading comic books, or, you know, I think video games are cool, I just don't have time. Like, who has time for that? Is that where that creature comes from? Someone that just physically and chronologically doesn't have access to peak nerd time. Are we creatures of the night? Are our habits regarding our sleep schedules and our activity schedules in respect to the clock somehow tied into the intensity of our nerdery? We've talked about the Star Wars trading card game in the past, I think, and one of the more interesting things about that was is a lot of guys in our dorms played it when it came out for various reasons, but mostly because we were hungry for anything Star Wars related. And we like gaming, and collecting cards is fun. But we used to play it at night after the dorms curfew. We'd play it out in the hallway. We never played at a table. We always laid everything out on the floor and played. There'd usually be a couple games going side by side. And it was a good time. But I often thought, almost all the games that I played at that, when we were at our peak, were played probably after midnight. Had we respected the intent of the dorm rules, not just the letter of the law, which allowed us to be up, but had we taken it seriously, we would have been in our rooms and we would not have been out playing a customizable card game in the hallway. So basically, just by obeying both the rules and normal human sleep schedules, it would have eliminated us from that hobby. We would not have got up early to play it before class. And quite frankly, that sweet spot in the afternoon after you get out of class and you're not really required to be anywhere yet, the last thing I wanted to do was sit down and play a card game. So there again, there's some evidence, I think, that you could tie directly to the intensity of someone's nerdism. The movies they watch, the games they play, the activities they engage in, are they more related to their likelihood to stay up late than anything else? Or are nerds born? Are you just a nerd? And it's like Jurassic Park, and nerdery will find a way. I'd be interested to hear what your take is. You can reach out to me on Carl Smith or at Carl Smith Writer on Twitter, or send me an email, carlsmithwriter@gmail.com. Had some great kind words about the show lately, which is rocket fuel for my interest in doing the show. So thanks for those of you who reached out. Thanks for making time in your busy schedules on these weeks when there's more than one episode. I know not all of you sit down and listen to them as soon as they drop. I do. But that's because I'm a narcissist, and that's also because I sort of do this weird editing thing where I kind of debrief myself on what was said on the episode and how it came out and how to improve in the future. So I listen to the episodes myself. So you can subtract exactly one listen to the numbers if anybody's ever privy to my listenership numbers. Subtract one, because that's the artist themselves listening to themselves talk over the radio. Plus, it's kind of fun. It's just magical to think that, again, as we talked about on a previous episode, I have been able to have basically my own radio show, a lifelong dream of mine, with a handful of listeners. But it's actually out there. It's something I can access through a widely distributed app. Not just something I recorded myself on a cassette tape and can play in my room and try to dub it off for my friends. It's different than that. The distribution system's different, and it seems more legitimate. So thank you for joining in this experiment with me and making me feel legitimate. We'll have a little bit more after the break. Speaking as someone who spends a lot of time parked in a parking lot, sort of away from other traffic, you wouldn't believe how many people are just parked in the parking lot away from other traffic. If you keep your eyes open, I'm always surprised. I always feel like a little put off by it, to be honest, that I'm not the only one parked out away from Target or at a playground or some other area where there's a lot of concrete and a place for me to pull off and record my podcast here in Council Bluffs. I mean, we talked about before how people will go out of their way to come up and drive next to you, sometimes even park by you, even though you're miles from the entrance to the store and there's ample parking. It's just this weird human nature thing where I think they're curious, or they just like to get people's goat, or they don't even realize they're doing it, but it just seems magnetic. The more you pull away from the crowd, it seems to attract, you know, a handful of people your way. From where I sit, I can see six different entrances to what would be normally termed a frontage road, except for in Council Bluffs, we can't ever design anything usable. It was a nice effort, but it's like if you gave a child a crayon and had him design a city for his Hot Wheel cars without any real experience of actually driving cars or moving traffic. That's sort of what Council Bluffs is, top to bottom. Whether it's the roads the city puts together or the design of shopping centers, you name it, the local schools. Traffic flow is a huge problem. But as I sit here and see all these entrances to that frontage road, which eventually leads to about two or three poorly placed driveways that lead out onto the main drag, you could literally choose any one of those entrances. And I've watched about a half dozen people drive about two or three additional lanes to drive right next to me. A woman in a Dodge truck just drove like mirror to mirror next to me. And I'm looking at probably 200 meters in any direction where there's no car parked. They could have drove anywhere. But she cut across the parking lot to nearly tap mirrors with the one car parked out here, to use the one exit out of half a dozen near where that same car is parked. It's strange how pulling yourself away from the pack almost attracts the pack towards you. And I'm looking at these other bodies out here in cars, sitting, talking on their phone, doing whatever it is they're doing. Sometimes I'm curious what they're up to, if they're killing time, engaged in some podcasting, who knows what. But they're not parked nearly as far away from the pack as I am. And, you know, my last three times I've recorded, I've seen the same phenomenon. I've seen other people in cars. It would make for an interesting concept for a book, maybe a story in our Blackhawk series. Sort of adds that level of creepiness, you know, like Ray Bradbury's story, The Crowd, you know, that the group of people that man realizes is always present at scenes of accidents or tragedy. He starts to recognize them on the news or when he happens to see the crowd itself. People hiding in everyday life, people almost Men in Black level, CIA, government spooks, whatever you want to call them, just sort of undercover, hanging out in plain sight. Makes you wonder what's going on. And it would make for an interesting story. You can make them villains, you can make them heroes. But speaking of villains and heroes, when we tell our stories in our different nerd fictions, whether it be in comic books or movies or novels, video games, it's always really interesting to me, and it's becoming more interesting to me as I get older, how we portray our heroes and villains. Who is the villain of the story? Why are they the villain of the story? What motivation justifies it? Or do you just need a monster of the week? And I'm not going to sit here and bash the monster of the week or the do-gooder Boy Scout superhero, because those two tropes have brought me a tremendous amount of joy in my life. I think as long as you commit to it and play by the rules that you set up yourself on those characters, it's fair game. Although I'm not a fan of like Deadpool or The Punisher, those characters work within their own rules, and you can tell when they aren't working within their own rules under different writers. But they're valid characters. They're not characters I find any joy in, but they're valid characters. They're serving a purpose. They're working under a certain set of physics and psychology that seems to work only in that setting. And the people who become villains in those stories make sense in relation to those same rules that are established and followed. But there has to be a methodology. You just can't have a guy that fights everybody and everything and attracts trouble. Just like you can't have a protagonist that has nothing to fight against, that just has a charmed life. There has to be some hurdle, some struggle. So where do you identify that struggle? We learn at an early age, you know, when we first are starting to learn about creative writing or deconstructing storytelling of any sort, that, you know, there's those three basic conflicts: man versus man versus nature, man versus the supernatural. So those are your villains, the versus part. But it's not always so clear of who really is the villain and why. If you look at something like a man versus nature, look at a story like The Ghost in the Darkness. They're hunting down two lions that aren't behaving like lions are expected to behave and are allowed to behave. They've sort of become almost mass murderers, hunting men for sport. And so that becomes a man versus nature story, where nature is the villain, and there seems to be a motivation that justifies it. But if you look at a show like Castaway, where Tom Hanks is on a desert island and it's man versus nature in that way, there's nothing insidious about nature. Nature is just doing what nature does. So nature is sort of a villain, but not really. There's really no motivation there. It could almost be said that it's a villainless story. Or that there's some sort of higher message to it that goes above conflict. You know, saying that it's about triumph. Triumph of the will. Triumph of man's stick-to-itiveness. I threw triumph of the will in there, but those of you who are students of history will cringe as much as I did as it came out of my mouth. But the ability for man to overcome their situation through ingenuity, through determination, through adaptability, through creative problem solving, it becomes kind of a character study. And it's weird to think that there can be a story that has triumph and challenge without a villain. Because that isn't always so in nerd culture. When we look at things like the typical Captain America comic book or the Fantastic Four or the X-Men or Batman, there's villains. And back in the old days, they would just introduce these wackadoo villains. They would have a gimmick. They'd have a shtick. Maybe a very dime store level motivation. But in the construct of those comics, it made perfect sense. It was fine. But as they became more self-important and more self-aware, and the medium itself kind of took itself more serious and tried to attempt to do some different things with its storytelling, making the story arcs a little more grand, a little more poignant. As these things started to occur, they didn't really change the villains as much, always. And so things became difficult. I think most readers won't pick up on it. As long as there's someone for Batman to punch, they're fine. But for those of us who are thinking fellers, sometimes we're asking ourselves, how does this really work? Who's really the villain here? I almost hate to invoke it because I think for our generation, I think it won't be discussed with any novelty until we're almost dead and gone and our sons and daughters have picked up the mantle and looked into the material of the 80s and 90s. But when you look into something like Watchmen, who was the villain in Watchmen? I mean, basically that was sort of the whole point of the story was the surface story anyway, was figuring out who the villain was. It was a whodunit. But who was really the villain? It's a very psychologically complex story. And I think being able to tell a story like that is what separates Alan Moore from a Carl Smith, maybe. There was a lot of moving parts. When there's more than one master to serve, and those masters are at odds with each other, do we tip our hat to the reader, to the viewer, to the listener, as to which one we're backing as God narrator? Or do we let them sort it out? Something like Game of Thrones, where there's all those different factions. And I haven't read all the books. I've only read part of the first book, so I've seen more of the show than I've read the books. And I didn't even watch the entire series. But I think from early on, you're meant to feel like the Stark family. Are the main protagonists. They're your source of righteousness. I've had three more cars drive by me as I'm recording this. This is unreal. It's really interesting. But, and there's a fourth. About clip my bike rack. But George R. R. Martin or the script writers who are adapting his work felt it necessary to give the audience someone to root for. Not necessarily making you root against, but it could have just as easily been a story about House Targaryen or Lannister. And I think towards the end, it looks like, from an outsider looking in, just following spoilers and people's reactions to the show, it looks like maybe, through the popularity of Khaleesi, that people sort of were backing her towards the end and had made her a protagonist of sorts. But ultimately, it came back around to House Stark being the force of good and everybody else were pawns, either against them, in their way, or just vassals to be recruited to help them eventually succeed. As I write my stories, I give a lot of thought of the villainy. Who's the villain? Why would they be a villain? Do we have a hero? Do they need to be the hero? Or is this just the person I've chosen to pick as my point of view? These are the things that go through my mind, and now that I'm thinking of this stuff 22 of the 24 hours a day, even when I'm not writing, I'm mulling over these ideas and trying to make sure that my stories make sense and adding artistic layers to it, psychological layers, as well as just the storytelling. You know, I'm starting to feel a little bit more like an actual writer, but I realize that there are a lot of decisions made on a regular basis regarding writing a story. And things typically don't just happen in a vacuum. That may have been the case early on with something like He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, as we've talked about over on the Make Eternia Great Again podcast, where they were just throwing things out there and like, oh, we got a guy, he's a skunk, we'll make him a bad guy, he stinks real bad. We'll just use the water guy's body, but we'll paint him like a skunk, and we'll give him armor that covers his nose to protect him from his own stink. And he's a bad guy. And he became a bad guy. But as we've grown and as we're adults, we deserve and we should expect more than that. Why is he a bad guy? Why is Stinkor a bad guy? Why does he fall under the command of Skeletor? Can't he be a good guy? Why can't someone stinky be a good guy? He uses powers for good. Or struggle to contain his differences to still achieve some sort of noble end. Why isn't he his own agent? You had this wonderful thing in the 80s where you had people scheming against the leader of the bad guys. That you could make the bad guy scary, you can make him a megalomaniac, but there was almost always someone undermining him. Because they were evil also, but they had that ambition for power. So you had Starscream, you had Evil Lyn. And so your villains, you know, you want a little more meat to them. Cobra Commander wants world domination. It's more of a Christian goal. World domination, which is also a Christian goal, by the way. But world domination is his main goal, and that's what he wants. He wants to be the emperor, the ruler of the world, under whatever methodology they poorly defined that belongs to Cobra. But then there's Destro and the Baroness. Who are warmongers and lovers of chaos, but want the power for themselves and don't see Cobra Commander as approaching the domination the right ways or for the right reasons. You can make an argument based on some of the comic books that there's other factions within there, Tomax and Zaymot, who believe in Cobra but not in Cobra Commander. Those villains, by accident or by the pure innate genius of Larry Hama, are a little more fleshed out than your average superhero villain. As we grew up, as the readership of comic books and video games and things grew up, I think the writing grew up a little bit too. They knew that they had to give some backstories. And what you see is like this resurgence of character pieces not told from the point of view of a hero. And some people aren't comfortable with it because they feel like it sympathizes or excuses the actions of a villain. And I don't think that's really a valid complaint. This Joker movie that's coming out, for instance, we're finally going to get something that spends quite a bit of time developing, I hope. Why he's a villain? What makes him a villain? Why wouldn't the Joker just as easily become the Punisher and hate crime and still be sadistic and violent, but do it to his own ends of good? Or is he just fixated on the Batman, something they probably won't address on the Joker movie? But in the comics, I know people have toyed with that idea that there's something about the Batman that he's fixated on. And all of his actions really just serve at him trying to get Batman's goat, to try to get negative attention from the Batman. And these things are interesting. This is how you build a villain. It's taken 40, 50 years for them to slowly develop this character from just a gimmicky clown-faced robber. When I was a kid, I had a real hard time with the Joker and the Riddler. I couldn't really keep their motivations all that separate. I mean, they're there, but you got to understand, as a kid, you don't always. I mean, they both deal with jokes. They tend to make the Riddler funny, and I think that's because of the shortcomings of the writers. The writers don't know how to write somebody as psychologically complex as someone fixated on riddles, because then you have to write those riddles. It's like me sitting down to try to write a whodunit. There's a way and a methodology and a psychology to a whodunit that not everybody can do. And if I tried to write one, you know, people who enjoy that genre might figure out who the villain is from part one. They linger a little bit too long on his eyes shifting or him being hesitant to take an order from the hero. So I've been researching and enjoying media in the Western vein lately because I'm writing that Western. And because I like Westerns and it's just a good excuse, I like to binge on a genre every once in a while, then put it aside. And I watched a wonderful movie last night called Heartbreak Pass from 1975. It's an Alistair MacLean story. It has Charles Bronson in it. and his wife, Jill Ireland, who is one of history's most incredible looks and tragic deaths. Really lost a struggle with breast cancer. And she just lived at the wrong time. I mean, you know, had she been born at a later generation, she'd still be with us as a survivor. And she used her tragedy and her notoriety, her fame, to open a lot of eyes to breast cancer awareness, breast cancer research, at a time when it wasn't being discussed publicly. So she's a marvel, she's a dynamo, she's in this movie as well. And the movie is a classic murders on a train set in the Old West, a train going through a somewhat obscure part of the Rocky Mountains. And there's all these diverse and dramatic persona on the train that don't belong there, because the train is primarily a military operation with just a handful of civilians. And you have to wonder what their motivations are, especially as people start showing up dead. And it's a wonderful, wonderful movie where the heroes and villains aren't always clear. Now, being a big budget Hollywood movie for the time, and being an action movie, which they didn't always take super serious, it yields the convention halfway through and starts to tip its hat a little bit. But as my father said when I told him I was watching it, it's a real nail biter, and he's right. It was a nail biter. And it wasn't so much because you couldn't figure out who was maybe involved, but why. A couple times they tip their hat, and I think they do it so you don't feel cheated, so it doesn't feel like, you know, God in the machine type of thing. But they sort of tip your hat and let you see what's going on at a second sight. And it spoils some of the mystery, some of the revelation. But it also helps other events that happen later on make a little more sense, takes away the confusion. But it's a movie with good motivations for its villains. Some of them are disposable, and they have a limited amount of screen time. It was a 90-minute movie, so what do you expect? Another movie in that Western vein, based on a Cormac McCarthy novel, No Country for Old Men, it's almost entirely about villainy. What makes someone a villain? What makes someone righteous? And what makes someone a victim? And is there ever really a reason? Or are villains just born? Do they just manifest to keep balance? It's really an interesting movie when you look at it a little deeper than what's happening on the screen. That's why the ending of that movie is so perfect, even though people were really upset about it. I think the only reason you could be upset about that movie is if you don't really understand the story that's going on just below the surface. So when I look at my stories and I look at who I'm making heroes and who I'm making villains, I put a lot of thought to it. You may not look at it the same way as I do when you read it. It may just kind of come off like there isn't anything additionally special here. This is just a story. And that's fine. That's going to happen. That means either I did my job and let the subtle current stay subtle, or I just haven't quite mastered in conveying the things that are happening in my head on the paper. But for instance, if you take one of my Blackhawk stories, To Kill a Fire, about a ranger by the name of Pembroke that attempts to fight the raging forest fire that threatens to consume all the timber, basically, in most of the Rocky Mountain range. Who's the villain in that story? Is it man versus nature? Yes. Is it man versus man? Yes, on several levels. Is it man versus supernatural? Yes, but in a way that I haven't really truly revealed explicitly, but will be referred to throughout Blackhawk's run here. But it's a story of heroes and villainy. We follow the efforts of Pembroke Collins, a ranger, Forest Ranger, who makes it his Ahab-like quest to save the world from this out-of-control forest fire. But is he the hero of the story? The answer, not to spoil the story for you, is no. He's not the hero. We follow him from beginning to end. We see the entire story unfold in relationship to him and his actions. Is he the villain? No, not necessarily. Maybe on a metaphysical level, he represents a type of villainy, but he's in no means the villain of the story. But the world's in trouble. And what allows it to be in further trouble is the presence of white males, white European males. Their policy, their actions. A forest fire is just nature versus nature. Those things happen. Lightning strikes, starts a fire, the blaze continues until there's nothing left to burn. Life starts over or it doesn't. There's no morality in that. There's no intent, there's no motivation. It's just cause and effect. But when you introduce man to that, trying to control, trying to manipulate, withholding resources, making mistakes, trying to rape the earth of its resources, and creating a situation where it's harder to contain naturally these ordinary events, then man becomes the villain. And in my book, specifically white males, white European males in that period of time. So who becomes the hero then? Is nature the hero? Do you root for the forest fire to wipe everything clean? To remove man and his twisted sense of order from a natural occurrence? Maybe. You could read that into that. I think I left enough of the door open for you to take that point of view and be happy with it, although that's not what I intended. Or is it up to someone else to step up and save the world because they can't count on these white European males to save the world from themselves? Maybe we, as a race, as a species, only move forward if we stop excluding women, if we stop excluding blacks, if we stop setting irrational value to things like money and profits, and pay more attention to integrity and forward thinking. So that's what that story is really about when it gets to it. And I don't get to talk about my story with people who have read it very often. But at the core, if you've read that story and didn't get any of that out of it, go back and read it again. Who are the heroes? Who are the villains of To Kill a Fire? A lot of consideration went into that. You wonder, why does it take Carl so long to write a 20,000-word short story, novella, whatever you want to call it? That's why. It's easy to come up with a plot. You can go to any website about writing, and they will give you a chart of what needs to happen in which order in a story for it to be satisfying. The introduction, the rise in conflict, the resolution, and then sort of the wrap-up from the consequences of the resolution. Or you can treat it like a dungeon design. Do that same pattern, but throw some sort of plot twist in there somewhere that changes the stakes, changes the expectations. That's how you hook people. Storytelling is about satisfying and challenging the expectations at the same time of your readership. So it's quite possible to write a book that doesn't sell many copies that in all ways is very technically sound and a good story. It just doesn't capture the hearts and minds of an audience to the extent that something like a Harry Potter does. But that doesn't mean the person that wrote that story neglected to adequately address who the heroes and villains are. And likewise, it doesn't mean that a story like 50 Shades or something like that, that is a runaway success suddenly, has a writer that bothered to spend any time developing characters and motivations. The success of a story rarely has much to say about the process. Readership is fickle. But for those of us who write or read for pleasure, as a hobby, on a higher level, these things matter to us, this development. And I think that's where, just to close out this segment, someone like Stan Lee does deserve a little bit of the credit that he gave himself, because he understood this. As wacky as Marvel Comics can be, there seemed to be something lurking beneath the surface. And we can debate who contributed the most to these storytelling, but it's pretty universal that all the characters from that golden age there of the 60s had some fun motivations. What made them the heroes? What made them the villains? Spider-Man, perhaps of all of them, is the most defined. And maybe that was not all Stan Lee. But he understood you couldn't just have these masked wrestlers fight every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks for very long and be satisfying. Think of all the pulp heroes out there. Doc Savage, The Shadow, Green Hornet, Zorro, Tarzan, The Lone Ranger. And how easily they'd been sort of pushed aside by time. And then think about the ones that are persistent for one reason or another. Is it because a Zorro doesn't have the considerations of what makes him a hero? Are Zorro's villains memorable at all for their motivations, for their caricatures? And how does that differ from Superman? I don't think it's as easy as that, but I think it's a question worth asking. Do stories do better when the writer develops its villains a little better? I could name 100 Westerns that I've seen in my lifetime and couldn't tell you much about them except for the Indians are the bad guy. Cowboys and Indians, or cowboys and robbers and outlaws. But what makes an outlaw an outlaw? He had a black hat on, he cheats at poker, he's just mean. Those aren't adequate descriptions of a villain. What makes an Indian a villain? Because they were here first, because they lived differently than the European settlers? Because they're the noble savages that have become territorial or lustful towards possessions of the white man. Those are dangerous narratives, and those are the narratives they used in real life to demonize Native people and not view them as independent nations, independent people that you can't lump together. So when you do so in fiction, you become just as forgettable. It becomes Gunsmoke. It becomes Bonanza, where there's sort of a conflict of the week and it gets resolved and there's no real depth. So I'd be kind of curious to hear from you guys. What makes a good villain? Who are some memorable villains? What are some nerd fictions that you feel like nailed the interplay of motivation? Maybe the original Dark Shadows series or Robotech. I'll even let you talk Watchmen if you want to. But what are some media where you can tell that the villains have been given some consideration as to why they're villains? Is there media where there's a POV that you follow, where the so-called protagonist isn't really the source of righteousness or holiness or of moral superiority? I'll throw out an example. If you haven't read it, I'd recommend reading any story in the chronological order. Michael Moorcock's Elric. He is a morally ambiguous character, and the stories follow his exploits. Sometimes he seems to be serving the greater good. Sometimes he's disgusting, and it's a story of just a villain fighting other villains. And sometimes the story could be told from another point of view, and he is the villain himself, slaying the righteous, but for the POV used. So what fiction have you seen that develops these two sides well, that you think is an interesting example of a POV change that affects how the reader views? Or give me an example, if you're feeling a little negative, of something that poorly defines a hero or a villain's motivation and has succeeded in spite of that. Because we need to be reminded that there isn't a magic formula to success for storytelling. Sometimes lesser thans are popular. Pac-Man made a lot of people rich. And it's a hockey puck eating sticks, getting chased by ghosts. Sticks and dots. Not a lot there to a narrative. So sometimes entertainment is just entertainment, and that's okay. We need to be reminded of that. But give me some examples as you reflect upon it. These discussions are always open over on Twitter, @CarlSmithWriter. Over email if you care to, CarlSmithWriter@gmail.com. If we're friends on Facebook, hit me up on there. Hit me on my DMs. Basically, anywhere you can get a hold of me, let's discuss this. And again, it's something I would be totally willing to revisit, recap on a future show if I get enough feedback. So what do you think? Heroes and villains? Let me know. Well, that does it for episode 21. Talked a little bit about working overnights, about our work schedule and our daily schedule somehow perhaps either contributing to our nerdiness or our nerdiness contributing to those schedules. Sort of an interesting psychological puzzle. We talked about heroes and villains. We talked about my book specifically, To Kill a Fire. I'd like to hear some more feedback. I appreciate the readership, the the listenership that I have here with Goat Kicker. And I'm always happy when you guys interact, not only because it tells me that someone's actually listening to this and not just downloading it, but because I want it to be a discussion. I haven't really dusted off the feature here, the call-in feature. There's a way for me to set this up somehow where you can call and leave me voicemails and they can be played on the show. And it can be like a call-in show, but where all the calls are canned. And I've wanted to mess around with that maybe at least once a month. But I definitely want to see more discussion before I get too tied up in figuring out a whole new technology. But that's something we have in mind. But I would like to see these things discussed a little more. So, you know, throw out some discussion to me online if it moves you. If these topics bore you or you're just not interested or don't have a take, that's fine. Don't feel pressured just because I'm begging. But if you do hear something on a Goat Kicker episode and it triggers any sort of commentary or response, I'm happy to hear it. Don't worry too much about saying something negative that might hurt my feelings or disagree with me. I'm okay with that. So anyway, I hope you guys have a great week. Thanks for sitting through 3 episodes of Goat Kicker this week. If you did, you should get some sort of a medal for that. There's 2 days left this week, but I'm teaching a class tomorrow and my overnight start Friday. I doubt that I'll be spending any time recording Goat Kicker for the next handful of days. So 3 is going to have to stand as the new record. You wanted the Goat Kicker, you got the Goat Kicker. Until next time, everybody, take it easy.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.